Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. Our technology isn't going to save us from a fourth extinction caused by a heating planet, but reforesting the planet will. Trees not only cool the planet, they're carbon sinks, clean our water, remediate toxins, have aromatic therapeutic terpenes and pheromones that prevent illnesses, including cancers. They soothe our habitat, preserve soil, humidity in the air, grow food, and basically protect us from ourselves. But not if we cut them all down, especially the oldest and strongest, as we have done. In their absence, the rising temperatures are leading to mass forest extinctions. More than 90% of America's old-growth forest is gone and is still being cut. In Europe, where trees used to cover 90% of the mainland, now they cover about 30% in fragmented conditions. Without full forest ecosystems, trees cannot survive climate change. In small parks, like museums, these last, largest, oldest beings will die unless we can reforest with trees as strong as the ancient ones. So tune in and plan on being inspired to contribute to this project and plant some of these trees. Let's look forward to cities where you can't see the buildings for the trees. First, an editorial by Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett.
Thank you, Lena. If you're in a room with 100 people, 20 of them will be chemically sensitive. What that means is that they react to such things as fragrance, paint, cleaning products, pesticides, glues, plastics, carpet, and car exhaust with anything from a headache to a seizure. That 1 in 5 statistic is taken from the latest contribution in the chemical sensitivity literature by researchers in Texas working with a group of 400 patients at two university clinics. One of their findings is that chemical sensitivity is associated with other sensitivities that include food allergies, drug and alcohol abuse, and adverse reactions to medications. Another of their findings is that physicians typically do not recognize the condition. The implication, of course, is that patients don't get the help they need because doctors mistakenly treat the symptom and not the underlying cause. Not only that, but in treating the symptom, a doctor is likely to prescribe a medication that the patient will react to badly. Instead, the researchers point out that truly effective treatment for the patient is to avoid the exposure altogether. If chemical sensitivity were caused by a virus, the CDC would have long ago declared an epidemic. That is unthinkable, although not unimaginable. It's unthinkable for two reasons. First, chemical sensitivity isn't anything like an infectious disease, which is what the CDC is set up to deal with. Second, there's no drug-like or vaccine-like treatment. Since avoidance is the best treatment, effective treatment would mean massive restrictions on the chemical industry, and that would mean a very different way of life. Unthinkable. The Texas researchers are certainly right to bring this issue to the attention of physicians, but uneducated doctors are hardly the problem, nor is the problem that patients aren't sufficiently educated, although that would help too. Even the best treatment doesn't solve the problem because in our political economy, avoidance of exposure means a self-imposed quarantine. Even that doesn't solve the problem. What's under discussion here are the acute, that is, short-term symptoms resulting from exposure to a toxicant. Quarantining sensitive people leaves the rest of us exposed. Do we know what the consequences of that are? I'll give you three examples that illustrate why the situation is bad and promises to get worse. Researchers conducted an experiment in which they exposed two groups of people to electromagnetic radiation, those who self-identified as electrosensitive and those who did not. After the exposure, the immune systems of both groups were on alert, essentially shifting to an inflammatory state. Inflammation, as I'm sure you know, is a culprit in a wide variety of chronic illnesses. In other words, even though you might not react acutely to EMF from cell phones, wireless routers, and such, your body is reacting with potentially long-term health effects. Lead has been poisoning us for a very long time. Great lengths have been taken to reduce exposures to safe levels. However, as a scientist at the National Toxicology Program recently said, quote, there's there does not appear to be a really safe level of lead exposure. The best course of action is to eliminate all lead exposure from our environment, end quote. In addition, the damage from lead now reaches beyond the well-known neurological effects to a wide variety of chronic conditions such as cardiovascular diseases and diabetes. Lead is not alone in this regard. In other words, the history of research on virtually all toxicants tells us that what we know about the health effects gets worse over time, not better, and affects chronic as well as acute illness. The third example concerns how an exposure affects not you, acutely or chronically, but your children and grandchildren. A recent study identified the epigenetic effect of five types of chemicals now actively dumped into our environment: pesticides, bisphenol A, phthalates, dioxin, and road surfacing materials. Rats exposed to these during gestation give birth to daughters who subsequently have ovarian diseases, including cancers. The granddaughters also have ovarian diseases. In other words, you might not experience any health impairment from chemical exposures, but your descendants might. We use products all the time that give us pleasure and perform useful services for us. You drive your kids to soccer practice. You drive to work. Those services are what you paid for when you bought the car. What you also paid for is the exhaust that harms chemically sensitive people, and likely people who are not. In addition to the services, you bought a bunch of disservices. Why can't you buy a means of transportation without buying the disservices? One idea promoted by economists is that the price of the disservices should be included in the price of the car. That's a stupid idea. It's part of the fantasy world imagined by champions of market economies. Instead, transportation products and the chemical products and all the products that they depend on should be designed to be useful and do little or no harm, period. And that's the problem. We don't have an effective way to do that yet. That would take a political economy in which we take responsibility for each other and for the consequences of what we produce and use. A transcript of this editorial is available at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Jeff Fawcett is a political economist, writer, and health integrationist who produces this show with me and is primary author of our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. Now to our topic for today, reforest the planet now. And I hope to have two guests. Let me first introduce who I know is on the line. Co-founder of the Champion Tree Project, David Millarch, M-I-L-A-R-C-H. David Millarch works to propagate and preserve the genetic heritage of the world's last and oldest growth forest giants, a fourth-generation nurseryman with four decades' experience in supplying landscape trees for the national market. Millarch seeks to revitalize stressed urban and watershed forests with selected robust strains. He has propagated more than 90 species, including the tallest redwoods and the oldest Bristol cone pines. His plantings grace campuses, botanical gardens, and public spaces from coast to coast. And we're really honored to have you with us, David Millarch. Welcome.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to be here.
And then do we have Jim Robbins also?
No, not yet.
We do not have Jim Robbins. Okay. Well, Jim Robbins wrote a book about David Millarch, and we had hoped to have both of them on the phone. But we can proceed with David. I'm sure we'd have no trouble filling the time. The book is called The Man Who Planted Trees, Lost Grove, Champion Trees, and an Urgent Plan to Save the Planet. And Jim Robbins is a freelance journalist who has written several books and works for several newspapers and magazines. David, since we're starting with you, I will have to look down here. I think it might be, I think it would be interesting for people to just hear what happened to you that got you involved. I mean, you were, as we said, you were a nurseryman. So you had experience, and you were always somebody who pushed yourself to the limits in both play and work. Something happened to you that made you suddenly kind of start very hard working on this project, harder than any person I know has ever worked on anything I'm aware of. So why don't you tell us that interesting story?
Well, I've always tried to do my very best in the most than I'm capable of, and I like going to the limits, mentally, physically, throughout my life. It's a challenge. And one of the limits that I went to was I had total renal failure. My kidneys and liver decided to stop functioning because of excessive amounts of alcohol. So I had a full-blown near-death experience in the hospital, and the doctor that was working on me said, "You're going to die." And I informed him that, "No, I'm not." Well, we were both right. I insisted that I go home. He said, "Go home. You only have 24 hours to live, maybe, if we put you on dialysis." I said, "No, I think I'll go home." So a friend of mine threw me over his shoulder.
Literally?
I went home. And later on that night, I'll be darned if he wasn't right. And I went through the tunnel of light to the other side, and I got the marching orders for the Champion Tree Project, which now is Archangel Ancient Tree Archive. Or in other words, go out across the country and around the world and archive the last of the ancient old-growth forest trees, the largest and oldest living things on Earth, archive and preserve their genetics in archival living libraries all over the country and all over the world. For instance, it's a fact, 98% of our old-growth forests here in the United States have been cut down. There in the Berkeley area, California area, where I've worked for 15 years, at least 95% of your coast redwoods have been killed, cut down, for hot tubs and building materials. And with the giant sequoias, the world's largest and oldest tree, supposedly, 3,000-year-old giants, 30 or 40% of those have been cut down. Well, the problem is that when we cut down all of these old-growth forests, we did that before we had a chance to study them. That's the tragedy. We did not know what these trees did, their key roles that they played. So for the sake of the dollar in most cases, or just plain ignorance, we went in and just mowed down 98% of our old growth forests. In California, it's about 95 or 96% of your redwoods are gone.
And they're still cutting them.
They're still cutting them. They cut them at night with helicopters. It's like in the Wild West where they used to rustle cattle, they rustle redwoods because why is there such a demand for redwood timber? Well, I've been informed by some of the people that have sold their trees that they are almost $500,000 for mature old-growth redwood in your yard. We'll come in, write you a check for a few $100,000. No mess, no fuss, we'll take care of it. And overnight you've got a very, very large, sizable amount of money. So it's money-based. And pretty much that's been the demise, other than fire, of all of our forests here in the United States and actually around the world.
Well, one thing that I hadn't realized till I read the book, well, there are several things, but one of them is I hadn't realized the extent of the destruction, but I also didn't realize that well, it's pretty obvious, actually, but you can't, if you destroy large pieces of ecosystem, if you leave only a few stands of these ancient redwoods in parks, they will not survive climate change because they need the whole ecosystem to cool the planet and to create this kind of moisture in the air that lowers the temperature, and without it, they will all die from the outside in.
Well, that's called the edge effect, which means that the trees that used to be in the center of the forest are now exposed to the sun and the hot winds and the elements. They're not in a communal family like they're used to growing in, and that pretty much takes them out. They're not used to it. That's not normal and lasts tens of thousands of years. But more importantly than that, what roles or what services do those old-growth forest giants do for all of us?
Please.
Well, it's pretty astounding, the science in Jim's book. I would really urge everyone to get a copy of The Man Who Planted Trees by Jim Robbins. In the book, Jim followed me around for 10 years around the world to the groves of the largest and oldest trees and asked a lot of questions. You know, why archive these genetics? Well, number one, Nobody ever has. So in the history of the world, no scientific body, no university or anyone that we know of, and we've had a website at Archangel Ancient Tree up for 4 years, and for 15 years at the Champion Tree Project, and no one's come forward and said, oh, we did say the genetics of this one species of trees. So one of the messages that was brought back over was, let's build like a Noah's Ark and fill that ark with the genetics, the last, the very last genetics of the world's largest and oldest things. So it had never been done. It hasn't been done since that we know of. And now we're finding out through epigenetics that old growth genetics, the genes, are very, very important for rebuilding our forests that have been selective cut. Let me tell you what happens. We not only go in the first time, 200 or 300 years ago, and cut down the best, straightest, largest trees for timber or whatever, for whatever purposes.
And give us an example of how large these trees were in diameter and stuff.
Well, there's the largest tree by volume on Earth is the giant sequoia, until we discovered that there were coast redwoods that were cut down 100 years ago whose trunks are 35 feet in diameter. Not circumference, diameter. So try and imagine, wherever you're listening, something 35 feet wide both ways,
mm-hmm,
and 400 feet tall.
Yep.
That's about 1,000 or more tons, or the size of 9 blue whales, the largest mammal on Earth.
And they're very similar to blue whales, too, I have to say.
Yes, they are. In fact, they are connected to whales in the oceans, and that's why they grow along the coastlines. Well, we've been cutting them for the last 200 to 300 years continuously because we didn't understand the critical roles they play, not just for our mammals in the ocean, not just for humans, but for all living things. The power of the dollar was more important than the study of the science. What role do the key ecosystems' role do they play? Well, there's hard science to prove right now that through deforesting the coastline of California, it affects the weather all the way to Montana. And as you said, the aerosols that are released out of the needles or the leaves and through the roots of these great trees play key critical environmental roles that have value that's much, much more valuable than the price of timber. So what we're doing is we're destroying our filter system. The Earth, the planet's filter system for air, water. We're destroying our the systems that naturally disinfect our air and our water and all living things that breathe these aerosols or have the aerosols come in contact with your skin. And these aerosols now are showing great promise in the medical world for cancers.
Asthma is another one.
A myriad of things, mm-hmm, that we need them for in those key roles. So, mm-hmm, if I might take 1 minute, imagine the most beautiful aquarium you've ever seen in your life. Can you see it in your mind's eye?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Can you see the beautiful fish?
Yes.
And the clarity of the water?
Oh, yes.
And can you see the plants growing in this beautiful aquarium?
Yes.
All right, so you're busy, so you walk away from your aquarium for a few days. But what you don't know is someone has gone and unplugged the filter system, and you didn't know it. And you return back in 3 or 4 days to see your beautiful aquarium again. What does it look like after the filter has been unplugged for 3 or 4 days?
It's mud.
What do the fish look like?
They're floating on the surface.
How about the plants of that beautiful
The plants
aquarium?
Are dying.
Well, how's the water quality? What does that look
it's
like?
It's murky.
Well, my friends, when we deforested this country and the planet, guess who's the fish?
Yeah, I know. Well, not just us. It's all the other creatures. I mean, one of the amazing things also in the book is the description of the fact that these old redwoods, and you and I talked about this yesterday. Well, also, let me just say, you're listening to your own health and fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I'm on the phone with David Millarch, M-I-L-A-R-C-H. He is the co-founder of the Champion Tree Project. Your website again, David?
Well, the Champion Tree Project has morphed into Archangel Ancient Tree Archive.
Yeah, that's where people can go.
Our website is ancienttreearchive.org. All one word, .org. We're
there you
a nonprofit.
Go. Okay. So, yes, very much so. What we talked about yesterday, because as I explained to you, I live in a redwood forest, although it's already been logged. This is second growth redwood. But these trees, the old growth redwoods forests, the canopies of the trees held on to each other. And the trees, the roots of the neighboring trees, they all are like a giant family and they hold on to each other. But in the canopy, 400 feet up or so, there are lakes and other trees growing and all this habitat for animals. And water.
There's an entire ecosystem of its own. The largest coast redwood, by the way, is Hyperion, and that's 380 feet-ish tall. But up in the canopies, there are large cavities in the side branches, large enough to support other trees, plants. There's also a whole myriad of life that lives up in the canopy in the hollows of these branches. It doesn't live down on the forest floor. But in the case of the coast redwoods, I have some good news. One of the things that kind of irks me is that all we hear is bad news. Bad news, bad. I don't need to hear any more bad news. All you need to do is watch the 6 o'clock news or watch the Weather Channel. It would so seem that the whole United States is burning up. But here's some good news. The experts told us it was impossible to clone 2,000 to 3,000-year-old coast redwoods and giant sequoias. The largest giant sequoias done at UC Berkeley and other places around the world were 80 years old. After that, the test results dropped down to zero. Well, we're pretty persistent and pretty stubborn, and I'm happy to report to everyone listening that we have cloned 50 to 60 of the largest coast redwoods alive today. We climbed the trees, gathered the material, brought them back to our propagation facility in Monterey, and for the first time ever, we've captured in a living library the genetics of your largest, oldest coast redwoods.
You should explain that this is not cloning the way people usually think of cloning animals in humans. This is more in the order of taking cuttings and getting them to root.
Well, most people don't understand that almost every species of tree on Earth self-clones. We did it so that we could, with the intention of, hey, let's take cuttings off these trees, try and coax them to root so that we can rebuild and reforest the 500-mile-long redwood forest from the Oregon coast all the way back down to Big Sur. Let's make that available to fix or put back. Well, for the first time in the history of the world, we can begin to rebuild the world's first old-growth coast redwood forest. And we had great success with the 3,000-year-old giant sequoias. We have 14 of those that we've coaxed roots onto for the first time in the world. And they're available to start to repair and rebuild giant sequoia forests. That's never been, no one's ever been able to do that before. We can't do that. We're not big enough, rich enough. But we can offer that to every homeowner, every organization, every business, every conservancy in California in that 500-mile range of the sequoias and the redwoods. We can put back what we've destroyed. That's the first, and I'm happy to announce that because we were not able to do that before. But we're doing that with other species here in the United States. And in Ireland, we've cloned 20-ish 1,000-year-old oak trees to help rebuild and put back the natural filter system of the ecosystems of the world. That's what we're all about.
Well, the other thing that's terribly important here is that you alluded to the handshake between the oceans and marine life and these trees, particularly the redwoods, the coastal trees, the sequoias. But the other thing is that these trees create a different climate. So there is a direct relationship to the destruction of the old-growth forests and the heating of the planet. The trees, particularly these enormous old trees, lower the temperature of the climate, and they create their own climate. If you've ever been in an old-growth forest, the temperature there will be distinctly different from outside of the area. And as you say, even one of the chilling stories in the book, too, is that you actually found some giant sequoias living on top of, in a higher altitude, in a dry climate, that shouldn't have been there, and they were very ancient trees.
The Lost Grove.
Yeah, so you were able to take cuttings there and start to try to grow those too, because we're going to need some trees that will be able to tolerate the change in climate as we rebuild these huge forests, because they don't grow. I mean, they grow fast, but it takes 100 years for them to even get really tall. Like the trees around here are what, would you say, Jeffrey, 100-something feet? 150 feet, something like that, which is pretty tall. But, you know, the old growth forest, you said, they're close to 400 feet. So to have that climate, but you can see the climate change even in this forest that we live in. You can feel it. So it's going to take a while. So we're going to need some trees that can tolerate the heat.
Well, here's a few facts of hard science, Jim. You know, Jim's is a reporter for the New York Times Science Times.
Right.
He's been a contributing writer for the Science Times for 30 years. There's hard science to prove right now trees attract rain. If you cut down the trees, it's called a desert. Or desertification, it doesn't rain. So if you want rain in your area, put the trees back, and the trees actually attract the rain. But here's some other good news that's attracted the attention of some of the earth scientists at NASA. A year ago in August, I was asked to present to 650 NASA scientists at their annual convention in San Francisco, and I did. And one of their interests was is that giant sequoias can live almost on every continent on the planet. Believe it or not, they're cold hardy to 25 below zero. That's pretty cool. But there's a couple of things that people don't realize about your precious sequoias and coast redwoods is that a giant sequoia is 1,000 tons in weight. 40% of that weight is stored dry carbon, dry weight. 40%. Now, Dr. Bill Libby, he taught at the U of C Berkeley for years. They call him God with a small G. He's the most renowned redwood and sequoia expert on the earth, in my opinion. Has there in Orinda, a suburb of San Francisco,
yes,
20 or 30 giant sequoias, and mostly coast redwoods, that the coast redwoods that he planted in his subdivision yard along the fence 30 years ago are now over 100 feet tall.
Oh, wonderful.
And I'm 6 foot three. I can't fit my arms around their trunk. So in 30 years, think of the carbon, 40% dry weight, that they've stored and the oxygen they've produced right there in Orinda in the backyard of a subdivision, 20 of them. So if we all got busy and utilized these trees, the coast redwoods, which are available, and the giant sequoias, and rebuilt those forests. But we did it, we can do it in our urban forests. There's lots of coast redwoods and lots of giant sequoias growing in almost every city north of Big Sur all the way to the Oregon border that we have found. A side note is that where the reforestation begins, not millions of acres of vast tracts of land to be reforested to stack the carbon, but it's right in your yard, your school, your church, your road. We all have to empower ourselves in one tree at a time, start to rebuild our urban forest. It's called point source remediation, where our cars, where our homes, where our toxins are released. Point source remediation. Every single person listening can plant 1, 2, or 10 trees, and in 30 years, they'll be 100 feet tall and 3 foot in diameter. That is really making some progress. And you can do it now with the genetics and the trees of the largest, oldest trees on the planet. So that's our gift, Archangel Asia Tree Archive, to the people of California and other people around the world, because coast redwoods and sequoias grow great in Ireland. They grow great in New Zealand. Giant sequoias grow great here in Michigan. And we can all start to capture, that which means sequester, and stack the carbon, that excess carbon that's in our atmosphere, and produce more oxygen. We can all do that. If you're 5 years old to 105 years old, we now have the ways and the means to go after this climate change scenario that we find ourselves in.
We need to take just a very brief musical break. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, Jeff Fawcett sitting by, and I'm talking on the phone with David Millarch, M-I-L-A-R-C-H. His organization is the, I keep not getting it right, the Angel...
Archangel.
Ancient Tree Archive. We're going to be right back if you stay with us. Just stay with us. We'll return to this interview. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett. We're on the phone today with David Millarch, M-I-L-A-R-C-H. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, for easier, extended access to our over 500 shows. Check out the changes to our library card feature. Find information about our practice, a free stream of this week's show, our book, and lots more. It's yourownhealthandfitness.org, or email us directly at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. And David, one more time, if you could give out the website for the Archangel Tree Project.
Anybody that'd like to get a hold of us, it's ancient, A-N-C-I-E-N-T, tree, T-R-E-E, archive, A-R-C-H-I-V-E, .org. All one word, ancienttreearchive.org. And you can see photographs of our climbers climbing the largest, oldest living things on the planet. And you can even see the babies that are available now to people all over the world of these really, really special trees.
Now, we had started talking about protecting the fisheries and the oceans with the big ancient trees. Can you explain that, what happens there?
Yes, in Japan, you know, Japan is a series of islands. As they deforested their islands, like all the rest of the countries in the world have done, they noticed a steep decline in their fisheries, and also their coral reefs started to die. Well, in Jim's book, The Man Who Planted Trees, there's you can read about the Japanese researchers that took the native trees and plants and started replanting a few miles of Japan's coastline, and lo and behold, as the plants and the trees reestablished themselves, they noticed an increase in the fish, and actually even the coral reefs started to come back to life. Trees, plants on the coastal areas are critical to the health of the mammals and the fishes of all of our coasts around the world. We did not know that until recently, so if you want to kill your fish and kill your reefs, if you want to affect all the mammals in a negative way, deforest your coastline so you get a better view of the water. That's exactly what you're going to get. If you'd like to reverse that and help the mammals, the oceans, the whales, the porpoises, the otters, and you want to help the fisheries and even your coral reefs, help reforest your coastline. And there's science now to prove that that helps bring them back. It's connected.
The trees have all of the trees, not just the redwoods and the sequoias, the ancient trees, but the big giant ones. But of course, there are other types of giant trees too. But trees in general, and all of them do this differently, have very profound biochemical effects on human beings.
Yes,
their hormones, their pheromones, their terpenes, their aerosols lower. They lower natural killer cells. They lower stress hormones.
Lane, it's Jim Robbins. I wanted to let you know I was here.
Oh, well.
I had a flat tire on my way back.
Oh, how awful. We were just talking. Well, Jim Robbins, again, is the author of The Man Who Planted Trees, Lost Groves, Champion Trees, An Urgent Plan to Save the Planet, as we said, 30-year science writer and journalist. Who's contributed all over the place and has traveled everywhere and has traveled around with Dave Millarch and written about him and experienced a lot of stuff. What we were just talking about is all of the studies that show the profound pharmacology of trees and what the science is showing in terms of how they affect human health.
That's right. I would say that there aren't many studies. There are some studies that showed trees can have an effect on human health, especially in Japan, where they call it forest bathing, walking through the woods, can have a big impact on stress in the human body. And it's pretty well shown, pre and post. But no one's taken this field here in the U.S. seriously. A lot of the compounds that come from trees, whether it's limonene or para-alcohol or methyl jasminate, are shown to be powerful chemo-preventatives and chemo-therapeutic agents, but no one's made the connection between the aerosols that come from trees and human health and whether these chemicals can prevent or even help slow the spread of cancer. One of the big ones is acetylsalicylic acid, which comes from
willows.
From willow trees, right. And aspirin has been shown to be a powerful chemo preventative and to slow the spread of cancer in a number of clinical studies. It's well established, but the connection hasn't been made between the native willows that grow along streams and whether the aerosols that they emit into the water and the air and the water that passes through them, whether it's somehow treated by this compound and has a chemo preventative effect in the environment. Not only for wildlife and fish, but perhaps for people as well. I would presume that would be something that researchers would want to take a look at, but so far I'm not aware of any studies along those lines.
Willows naturally grow in swampy areas along creeks, and they have a profound effect on filtering and cleaning up water and doing remediation. Talk about some of the projects that people are doing with willow trees and what they do with water quality and sewage and all that.
Right. Well, David's been involved in one of those near his home in Michigan, and essentially they take poplars or willows. Those are the ones that have the biggest root mass, and they plant those on toxic waste sites. Might be anything from dry cleaning solvent to toxic chemicals, you know, any kind of. Some of the most severe toxic waste can be cleaned up with willows and aspens, and it's done. But you know, our industry is devoted to phytoremediation. It's called plant remediation. And it's being used all over the country at certain sites. It's not appropriate for everywhere, but at certain sites it works very well. It's a fraction of the cost of other kinds of remediation and can get things that a digging up or treatment otherwise won't get. I talked in the book about a town in Sweden that has a willow plantation where they treat all of their organic waste from the sewage treatment aspect from they did away with their sewage treatment plant and built a willow plantation, and they use willows only to treat all of their sewage and other organic waste, and then they harvest the willows to use in a biofuel plant to burn for electricity. So there's a lot of options out there in terms of what trees can do as far as, you know, filtering and cleaning up the environment.
Jim, you had a very profound experience. You bought a beautiful piece of land that was forested in Montana 15 years ago, and something happened and that really spurred you on to write this book. You want to tell the audience?
Well, I think it was 2005. We noticed a few trees had died from a bark beetle that burrows into through the bark and girdles the tree, essentially, and cuts it off from the roots and kills it. And the next year, 2006, we noticed there were a couple of dozen trees, and I think within 4 or 5 years, all the trees on our 15 acres were dead, or virtually all of them. There's a handful left. But they were all killed by a bark beetle that hadn't been much of a problem before. I mean, some of these trees are 200 and 300 years old. But we have had warmer weather here that's, among the most extreme in the country. We had last year was the first year I've been here, and I've been here for 30 some years, that we had no below zero weather, and that's just unheard of. And it takes 30 to 40 below zero to kill these bugs, which can do in the trees. And so we've seen a lot of trees around Montana and the West, British Columbia and Canada, dying because this bug has been given a new or expanded lease on life because there's the cold temperatures we used to get are no longer. I talked to a climate scientist in Missoula who told me that the average temperature in the West has gone up 2 degrees in the last 50 years, but the wintertime minimum temperature, which is the coldest it gets, has gone up 15 or 20 degrees. which is unheard of in climate science, that kind of temperature swing. But that's what's happened here, and that means that the bugs have no problem getting through the winters, and so they can do a lot more damage. For me, the signature loss of trees was the bristlecone pine, which is 4,000 to 5,000 years old at the oldest. Methuselah is one of those trees, and that's one of the trees David and his family grew seedlings of. And all of those trees are going to die, all the bristlecone pines, because it's so much warmer at the mountaintops, and we're getting bugs into that range that have never been there before. Those trees staked out a very inhospitable part of the planet to live and survive, and now it's not inhospitable anymore, and so the bugs can live there and thrive. And then there's also an exotic fungus that's hitting them that came over in 1900 from Europe. And those two things together are just are killing the bristlecones. And I think it's a great loss to this country and to the world. And those are the kinds of things that can happen to trees, things we can't foresee or predict, just these anomalies that climate change is bringing. And it might be storms, it might be less fog, as it is with the redwoods and those types of changes. But the changes could be legion, and they could do great damage.
Well, indeed, it did great damage where you live, and now, of course, what's happening is that we're having these enormous forest fires, Colorado, acres and acres and acres, thousands of acres are burning. So trees are burning down, too, along with being killed by oak death here in California and these beetles and stuff because of the changes in the climate and the inability of the trees to create their own little climate around there. Now, one of the things that is astonishing about this whole project that David's involved in is that when you guys all went out, and Jim, you went along to collect samples, you were not allowed to go into old growth parks. So, David, you want to say something about that? Or?
Yes, the national parks and the state parks, you're not allowed to harvest any of the genetic material, which are cuttings. 2 or 3 inch long pieces of the tips of the branches. Doesn't hurt the tree at all. Even though we own the forest, the people of the United States, we were not allowed to gather any of that material from your state or national parks for political reasons. I've tried to understand it, but it's nearly impossible to get a permit to do scientific research.
Yeah, it's so ironic.
The material, genetic material.
So you've had to go to private people to you've been and I guess even the listening audience, if anyone knows, well, except you get contacted an awful lot from people who think they've got an ancient tree. Do you still want people to contact you?
Yes. What we're really looking for is people that have an old growth stand, a fragmented stand, or they have an old growth tree in their yard or their town. We're also looking for places to plant these trees. The world's first clones of these great trees. Let's put them to work.
So how many acres does somebody have to contact you for a tree?
5 acres would be ideal. Mm-hmm. Somewhere within the range from the Oregon border all the way down to Big Sur, wherever the coast redwoods grew or the giant sequoias, we're looking for a place. And also financial support. It's expensive to do this. To help start to rebuild the world's first old-growth forest.
Yeah, it's not only expensive, but you've had lots of things get in the way. And the book ends, Jim, with some bad news about David's situation. And David told me something good happened recently. David, you want to tell us what happened and how it got fixed so that you're starting to be okay again with the project?
Well, the project was funded for 3 years by a very benevolent person, and after 3 years, that funding ran out. So we found ourselves unemployed, my sons and I, after 20 years of working in the project. It was shrunk down to a skeleton crew, and I have been unemployed for almost a year. One of the changes that was made here about a month ago is that our oldest son, Jared, who's 33, was asked to be chairman of the board and executive director. So he took that assignment, so to say, or that challenge, And he is now the new chairman of the board and executive director. And we're forming a new board, and we're looking for the third phase of funding. And it seems like what was lost is there's a brighter light, and there's hope now that we'll be able to continue on Archangel Ancient Tree Archive and continue our work around the planet. But we need your help, really.
So go ahead and give out the website again.
It's Ancient Tree Archive, ANCIENTTREEARCHIVE.org. We're a 501c3 nonprofit. And we're working to clone the 100 largest and oldest species of trees on the planet that stack carbon faster and better, pick up poisons out of our soil and our water and our air faster than better than the other thousands of species of trees, and make them available to start to reforest this planet yard by yard, city by city, county by county, and go after this climate change scenario we find ourselves in.
So once again, just very quickly, you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I've got David Miller, who you just heard speaking on the phone with Jim Robbins, who is the author of the book, The Man Who Planted Trees, The Man Who Planted Trees being David Miller. And Jim Robbins, you had something.
I wanted to say that I think trees have been overlooked. I think that one of the things both David and I are trying to do is reframe the way we think about trees. I think about them as an ecotechnology to solve a lot of our most pressing environmental problems, as David does. It's whether it's, you know, using them to treat sewage, or whether it's using them to for medicinal reasons, or whether one of the big problems in the Gulf of Mexico is a giant dead zone that comes from too much nitrogen being used on cornfields across the Midwest, and it runs off into the Mississippi River, into the Gulf of Mexico, and then causes algae to grow exponentially, which consumes a lot of the oxygen, and fish can't live there. And the one dead zone I'm aware of is the size of New Jersey. It's huge, and it's essentially killed the ocean. The same thing happens in the Chesapeake Bay, and trees could be used as kind of for phytoremediation to clean up a lot of those kinds of problems of excess nitrate and phosphate pollution all over the country. It's a big problem. And the U.S. Department of Agriculture has recognized this, and they're also advocating the use of what they call agroforestry, which is using trees in agricultural situations to solve a lot of the problems of modern agriculture and the way we practice agriculture. It can be used, especially as it gets hot. I mean, this is a record drought year in the Midwest, and trees could be used to shade crops in certain areas in order to keep things cooler and to keep soil moisture loss to a minimum. So there's a lot of things out there that trees can be used for to kind of reclaim and harness important attributes in order to make our lives easier and less consumptive.
But also not just to think of what we need from them, but the stories that you tell of how the trees were harvested and how, I mean, it's a little bit like whaling. It's a little bit like what happened with the whaling that took place. I mean, it's, and still does. It's so breathtaking when you consider that these are the oldest living beings on the planet. And it's clear that they also communicate with each other. Jim, you write about trees and their electromagnetic fields, and I think it's worth remembering this because we are now seeing with the increase in the number of smart meters and cell towers and stuff that trees and plants are being harmed from proximity to these extra layers of electromagnetic fields that are non-native. But can you talk a little bit about trees and their electromagnetic fields?
Well, you know, it's just one more area. Our ignorance about trees is breathtaking, really, and all the changes we've made to the world without knowing, anything really at all about forests and trees and how they function. And one of those things is the electrical role. And the trees generate electricity. They've harnessed that. It's a very small amount. I'm not sure how much it is, millivolts. And they use it to run a sensor to warn about forest fires. I mean, there's that much electricity in trees, and no one really is really sure what that means in a bigger sense. But some people think they're kind of conductors of electricity across the planet and affect the weather and how clouds move. there's a lot of speculation, but it's one of those areas that just hasn't been that well studied and not much is known. And it's funny, here we are in the last hours, perhaps, because of climate change and the way things are going, and we're just starting to kind of understand and realize, some people are anyway, that trees might be vital to the human endeavor. So it's kind of frightening in a way. But hopefully people will start to wake up and see what's going on and realize that trees cradle our existence. They're very important, and we need to make sure they survive.
So, David, you're very clear, and I am too, and we can only say that this is what we feel, but it seems very clear to me that trees do communicate, and they clearly communicate with each other. As Jim alluded, they will... Trees, if they wire up trees and they check, they will send out an alarm if something is wrong to the other trees.
Yes, they do. They send out several types of alarms. When you wire up the trees, as Jim writes about in the book, the scientific research that's done, just think about this, that when you chop down a tree or you take an axe to a tree, it'll be felt and the meters will spike. But the other trees that are wired into that family of trees, so even they feel what's happening to one of them, and it's registered. That's hard science.
Yeah. Next time you want to put a nail in a tree, I mean, or a bolt in a tree, think about that.
Next time we start to cut down our forest, can you imagine that if they're living, breathing, feeling, intelligent beings? And as we took them down one by one, all the rest of them knew that and felt that experience as each one of them came to their demise.
And they are older than anything else on the planet. Jim, you were trying to say something there, too?
One of the studies that was done in California was done with sagebrush. And what happens when one sagebrush tree is attacked by a grasshopper or other kind of insect, they release a hormone called methyljasminate. And it alerts other, and this is one pathway, there might be other ways, it alerts other sagebrush that they're being attacked, and then all of the sagebrush prepare a defense, a chemical defense against the insect that makes something that makes the leaf taste bad to the insect. So there are at least a couple of ways, as decided by the people who've bothered to take a look at it, show that trees do communicate with each other. Trees seem to have a collective immune system. If one tree is attacked by a disease, it can protect itself in future years against that disease, but it also then can pass that immunity on to other trees.
I don't know about that, but I wouldn't doubt it.
They have
a lot of other aspects to it. There was a long interview in Scientific American with a scientist who said that he thought that plants had... We're sentient beings, essentially.
Yeah, I think. There's no question in my mind. And the other thing that is interesting that people neglect to understand is that forests need to be forests. Trees, roots interact with, they hold on to each other. They prevent each other from falling. Trees fall when they're planted alone by themselves out in, you know, near a house in a suburban area or something. Trees don't fall as much in the forest unless they're really old or something makes them sick. They tend to hang on to each other. David, you know, I'd love it if you told a story from the book about your experience meeting Bobby Billy. The Indian story. Yeah, tell us that story. I think it's a wonderful story because you've met some extraordinary people that are also helping with everything.
Well, there are a lot of extraordinary people all over the planet that revere and love old growth trees and old growth forests. And I have met many, many Native American indigenous leaders and indigenous spiritual leaders on some of the most unbelievable circumstances. They call it the Indian Telegraph. It seems like wherever I go, they sort of seem to know that I'm coming there to work on their trees or whatever, really, and they just seem to show up. Well, this was another Bobby Billy, is not his real name, but it's his white person's name for the religious leader of the Seminoles in Florida. He doesn't let out his Native American name, and truly, this really did happen. I was working at Selby Botanical Gardens down in Florida, and the newspaper covered we were cloning some of the old-growth pines and oaks of Florida, And that made the Associated Press and went out to newspapers all over the country, all over Florida. And I got a phone call the next morning after the newspapers were released, and someone asked me if I would agree to meet with Bobby Billy. I said, well, maybe. I was in Venice, Florida. And they said, well, Bobby Billy is the spiritual and the leader of the Seminole Native people, indigenous people of Florida. He'd like to meet you at Bock Towers. I said, where's Bock Towers? Well, that's in Central Florida. Well, I said, I don't really know how to get there, but sure, why not? So I said, how about Saturday? So I left Venice, and it's about a 2.5-hour drive north and east towards Bock Towers in Central Florida. And about 2 hours into the trip, I noticed I was low on gas. So I left the highway, the major highway, pulled into a gas station, got the gas, and went inside to pay for it. And lo and behold, there was a person standing there with long black hair, a smile on his face, with a couple of friends. And as I put my charge card on the desk, they came up and they said, this is Bobby Billy. And my jaw dropped. I said, how in the world did you know that I was going to buy gas 30 miles from where we're supposed to meet? They said, well, we just know things. So let's go to the Bock Tower. So I was pretty rattled. But I followed the Bock Towers, and my back, I've always had trouble with my lower back. I've had some bad car accidents and other various sundry injuries. I went to Bock Towers, and Bobby Billy explained how all of that region that's now citrus used to be virgin oak forest.
We have to speed it up a little because we're running out of time, but quickly.
Make a long story short, he called in a red-tailed hawk, brought it down, brought some information through the red-tailed hawk and said that their stories tell about the great white bear of the north would come back to Florida and help replace their old-growth forest. And he wanted to tell me that, and it was one of the most incredible experiences I've ever had.
He also had a gray, very large gray squirrel come and run back and forth across your back, and your pain went away.
We were sitting out in the parking lot on the lawn, and there was one lone, real large oak tree, a live oak, and Bobby Billy whistled, and a large gray squirrel, a really big one, came down the tree, ran across the blacktop, came over, and he said, don't worry. And I was sitting there, and that large squirrel came up behind me and started walking and rubbing his back against my lower back two or three times. Well, I wasn't afraid, but I was sure interested. And then the squirrel ran back and went back to the... Well, anyway...
Yeah, your pain is gone.
My pain was gone. The squirrel took the pain for the healing and took it back and released it into the tree. And that's a true story.
I believe it. So ancienttreearchive.org, David?
Yes.
Ancienttreearchive.org is David Millerk's website. Please go there and send whatever you can and get trees and start planting them. Jim Robbins, the author of The Man Who Planted Trees, a wonderful book. I enjoyed this book so much. I thank you both so much for the work you're doing. It's so important. Please let's stay in contact. I'm very grateful for what you're doing.
Okay, Linda, thank you.
Thank you both. Okay, bye-bye for now.
Bye.
I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, for easier extended access to our archive shows, our library card, our practice. Links will be there, free stream of this week's show, our book, and lots more. yourownhealthandfitness.org, or email us at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.